starting today. And so, yeah, I hope you can join us, you can hear us. And today we start with our first talk by Joran. And he will just introduce himself. And after his talk, there are options where you can just write questions and he will try to answer them. And I hope we have a really lively discussion then. So welcome, and I just give the word to Joran.
Hello, hello. My name is Joram. I hope you can all see me and hear me well. It's a little bit weird. You are represented to me right now with a little webcam on a laptop monitor. So let's try this together, shall we? So my name is Joram. I'm a science communicator, and I didn't start with that job. I was actually a scientist before, and today I want to use this career talk opportunity to walk you through a little bit through the things that I have done in the past and the things that I have learned from them, because I think there might be one or two things that are interesting to you. So when I was invited and I was thinking about career, this is the image that I had and I think many people have. It's just like you have this solid track that goes from A to B, and there are stations on the way where you stop and change, and that sort of define different points of your CV, and then you go from one place to the next place. Pretty much on rails, there's not much that you can do. And you embark at the beginning and you end up at your destination that you chose, and it might take a while, but you'll get there. But when I was looking back at my own career, I came to the conclusion that there is no such thing as a career track. A much better example how this works, a better image, and this is the analogy that I will use throughout this talk, is that career is like a footpath. So you have a starting point, you have a destination in mind, and you want to get from A to B. And there are paths that you can take, but you can also go cross-country if you want. It's easier to stay on the worn-out tracks, on the path that other people took. But if they don't work for you, if for whatever reason they don't get where you want to go, you can just go cross-country and leave career tracks, leave things that are sort of set in stone for you, because they are not. And yeah, this is sort of my philosophy that guided me through my career. And my career began much longer ago, a while ago. So I call this now phase zero. This was sometime before 2007. In 2007, I did my high school degree. And there I started working. You could call it journalism if you want to be fancy, but in reality, it was my school newspaper that I started with a friend together. It hadn't existed for a while, and we restarted it, and we published a couple of issues. I got in touch with a couple of journalists in a youth journalism organization in Berlin, and through that got really interested in the idea of being a journalist, writing about things that matter and presenting that and have people read my words and do classic journalism work. And then at one of these events of this youth journalist organization, I talked to an older journalist, and he told me, if you want to be a journalist, you should become an expert in a field, because their formally studied journalists are a dime a dozen. So there's just so many people who do the general studies of journalism that if you want to compete in the marketplace for jobs, it will be really hard if all you can do is just journalism. So if you become an expert, and I always really cared about natural sciences, so if I would become a natural science expert, I could then go into science journalism later on. And that was sort of the idea that I had in mind when I started my studies. And so I began with engineering. This on the image that I hope you can see is a fermenter. This is like an old-timey image that I found, but this is pretty much what my degree was all about. I studied biotechnology in Berlin at the Technical University and got an engineering degree here. And that study is all about fermenters. It's about growing microorganisms in fermenters to produce compounds, to make just simple yeast extract in some cases. So it's quite interesting, touches a lot of genetics and biology. But in the end, when I finished my degree, I came to a fork in the road. And again, here I have my image of my path. So I came with my biotechnology degree, and I had pretty much two directions I could go. The one is bacteria and fungi, so microorganisms that I could grow in fermenters and do whatever with them, make drugs and compounds. Or I could go the other path and kill mice in medical research, where I would then use tissue cell lines and mouse cell lines and so on, and work there and apply my biotechnology skills there. And both of these paths didn't really interest me that much. And then when I look closely, there's actually this hidden path you can see here on the image, and that led to plants. Because there's plant biotechnology, it's not great in Germany. It's sort of also at the technical uni an afterthought. It's like one bullet point on the biotechnology overview slide is, there's medical biotechnology, there's technical biotechnology, there's also plant biotechnology, but nobody does that. Turns out some people did that, and also here in Berlin. And so from there, I moved on and had my first learning from my studies. And that is, not all paths are equally visible. So you might think that you have a very clear set of decisions that you have to make, but often there are additional options and options that fit much better to you than what is presented to you. So with then I moved on. I started a PhD in molecular plant biology at the Max Planck Institute in Potsdam. And this is a photo actually from my thesis that I'm still writing to this day, where I worked with tobacco, and I worked with the young tissue of tobacco. You could see this is from 3 months old tobacco plants. This is the entire tissue. The one on the bottom at the base of the leaf is the tissue I would harvest. So I would harvest like hundreds of these plants in a cold room, and then do experiments on them. And just because I have this nice graphic that I made for my PhD project, I want to present you very briefly what I was working on there. I was trying to figure out photosystem 1 assembly. So photosystem 1, a part of the photosynthetic electron transport chain in the chloroplast, so the green part in the plastid, important for photosynthesis and so on, but we don't really know how it's made. At least we didn't when I started my PhD. So I worked on this protein assembly, did a lot of protein biochemistry stuff, mass spectrometry and so on. Without much success, I couldn't really figure out much more than what was previously known, partly because of bad luck, as it sometimes happens, partly because of bad experiment design, partly because I just didn't work on weekends. And 1 year after I finished my lab work, other groups figured out how photosystem 1 assembly works. And so this is not a very great outcome of my PhD project, but luckily, in parallel to my phase 2, I did phase 2.5, where I did a little bit of science communication. And you see again by the, from this image, a great path, two paths next to each other. So sometimes there can you have paths that go in parallel for a while, and maybe they branch off eventually. And for me, the parallel path was science communication. I got involved in pretty much any outreach opportunity that I had at my institute. I was part of the Potsdamer Tag der Wissenschaften, where I presented the work of our institute. I took part in a science slam and got the first prize there, which was very exciting. Helped with other open days at the institute. And then also outside the institute, I got involved with the Science Hack Day Berlin, which is a really cool project there, where we organized, and I have to say that in the past, because right now I'm not part of the current organizing team, although they carry on with their work. We organized a weekend, 1 weekend per year, where people who care about science and hacking could come together for free, spend 3 days together and do all sorts of crazy projects. We had people building a mushroom growth cabinet, visualize MRI scans. We even had some people who brought a nanopore sequencer and ran some nanopore sequencing in the course of a weekend on a benchtop in the middle of a hack space. So that was very exciting. We were involved in like organizing these events. We were looking for locations, pretty much doing the full job of event organization, and then also running the event during the weekend and all of the marketing around it, pretty much everything in a small team. We were between 5 and 10 people, and that was really exciting. So I got my hands sort of dirty with science communication there. And the learning I had from this phase two was that you can have more than one career going at the same time. You might be working in the lab as a PhD student, but you can set the foundation for other things. In my case, there was science communication, maybe there's other related things. There is a career that you can sort of pursue in your own time to build the blocks that you need to have an interesting CV that people will care about and hire you then. So that brought me to the end of my PhD project. My phase three is the decision phase, because it actually took a while for me to figure out what I wanted to do. I had again these two paths in front of me, industry and academia, and I choose the dark color for the academia here on purpose, because to me at the end of my PhD project, it was a pretty dark place. It didn't look very exciting. I had no prospect to find a job or anything in academia, postdoc, because of my great success with my PhD project. So I, should I try to apply for industry positions? And what I chose was again the middle ground, the thing that is, or the alternative that's not presented openly to me. And I was lucky to get a job in science communication. I worked with office, a science communication office in Potsdam, actually attached to the institute I was working at, so I got really lucky in getting that job. And there I worked in science communication for a federal ministry project from the Federal Ministry of Science and Research, the BMBF, where we had a comparatively small project where we would do the communication for a plant research grant, where we had about 20, 25 groups that were organized, and I was asked to come up with a communication concept there. And so I worked there with stuff for YouTube, I did stuff on social media, we organized events, workshops, trainings, and because it was sort of my last main job, I want to walk you through a couple of the things I was doing there. The first thing is the YouTube project, A Forge CRISPR, which dealt with CRISPR, as you can get from the title. And there I came up with the concept of a YouTube channel where we could display the stuff that's done in the research around CRISPR and plants, organized by this research grant from the federal ministry. And we actually gathered a couple of active researchers, some PhD students, and taught them how to produce videos on their own, how to use cameras, how to use software, how to come up with a concept and idea, how to work and so on. And together we created a couple of videos on this channel, and everything revolved sort of around CRISPR and plant science. Because I'm not actively researching and we lacked sort of a couple of researchers that we could work with, I jumped in and created some videos on my own. And I traveled to different research groups, interviewed the researchers there, and presented their work and tried to be creative about the way I would represent it. At one point, I was trying to show the difference between mutagenesis breeding and CRISPR breeding, and would just spray paint on pieces of paper to show the randomness of mutagenesis painting, and then used a fine brush to just color in the one place I wanted to be colored to show how you would do it with CRISPR. So this was the sort of simplifications I would do to teach people about the idea of CRISPR and mutagenesis. And with that video, with the splashing of the color, I actually won the second place in the Fast Forward Science Video Award contest of science communication video on YouTube. So yeah, that was a sort of a nice project. But you can tell also from the views here that you see on the screenshot that the views weren't that great. So we put in a lot of effort, but it's really hard to run a good YouTube channel. The other thing that I was doing there is the Plant 2030 Academy. Plant 2030 being the office I was working at, and the Academy was an offer that we created for young researchers to get involved or learn stuff, soft skills, additional skills on top of their research skills. So we would bring them, for example, to Jülich, to the Pflanzenforschungszentrum or the Forschungszentrum Jülich, where they have a massive phenotyping station. So they have robots and automated systems that move plants around and take pictures of the plants to very quickly screen hundreds and thousands of plants for new traits. And we brought them there, and there they learned about plant phenotyping, they learned about project management and a couple of these things. And the main thing that I was involved in, apart from the event organization, was online courses. So I came up with an online course for scientific poster design, and later we also did another one on, I think, scientific presentations in general. And I would set up an online class, which is sort of, ironic speaking for me speaking now into an online system because we can't meet in person. We sort of preceded that with this project, and that was also really exciting. I could come up with a lot of different topics I wanted to present and create all of the content there, create the graphics, the video, and everything. And finally, I want to talk about a thing here that's very close to my heart, because this is not really work related. It's definitely science communication, but this is something that I'm doing sort of in my own time. I don't have any institutional backing for this. And this is Plants and Pipettes. Plants and Pipettes is a blog that I run together with my very good friend Tegan. We work together at the Max Planck Institute and now sort of are in different places. She's in London by now. And we write, illustrate, and publish about 2 articles per week on plant science. We talk about molecular plant biology and we try to break it down into words and stories that are easily understandable, so that people who are not familiar with plant biology can get an understanding of what's going on in research. So we work a lot with the actual research papers, with published research, and then translate it. My task there is, apart from writing, which we do both, I create all of the imagery that we use, run the website and all of these things. So again, many different skills and things that I can play around with there and gather experience and get better at it. We also produce a podcast every week. We release a new episode where we continue the topic, and instead of writing about, we talk about a current research paper and have some other segments there, like presenting important non-white male researchers in plant biology that are often overlooked. And yeah, it's just a very cool playground that we have, and I am very proud of the things that we do there to work in science communication and try out different formats, try out different things, run social media and so on, where we don't have any institutional backup or anyone telling us what we should do, what image we should preserve, there are no rules, and we can do whatever we want, and that's really cool. And sort of my take home from this whole section, this whole science com, this professional science com thing, is that there are places in between academia and industry. You just have to find them. They're not often very well advertised, or you have to know the right keywords to find them, but they do exist, and there are many more than just science communication. There's like scientific writing, there is editing. Tegan, my friend, she's now working for a publisher and editing articles. So she's sort of the person that you send your research articles to, and she distributes them to the experts that write their reviews about it. So you just have to find these places. If you don't feel right at home in academia or industry, it's a very high chance that there is a place where you can use the skills that you have, just sort of related and attached to these 2 main pillars in post-PhD career. So what am I doing now? In 2019, I got a happy boy that you see a picture here. It's from last summer. He's much bigger now. And I went on paternity leave, and I took some time off, and now I'm starting again with science communication with different jobs. Probably not as closely related to plants anymore in the future, but yeah, I'm just, my paternity leave is about to end and I'm changing. So also something I really want to recommend you, if you have the chance, if your situation allows it, take a break like that, go on a paternity, maternity leave, take some time off, and then like sharpen your idea of what you want to do with your career and come back. And now I want to talk about a few things that I don't see talked about very often in career talks, which is, first off, luck. I got lucky in several places during my career. So often I have the feeling when people talk about their career, it's like somebody winning a lottery telling you which numbers they picked, so you can pick the same numbers, so you can win the lottery the same way. Because if you do everything exactly the way I did it, you still might not end up where I am right now. And I think it's important to acknowledge that. So I got lucky when I got my PhD position, for example. This position just opened when I was finishing my diploma thesis that I did also in the same lab. And this position opened, and my boss knew me, liked me, and so I sort of could start directly after I handed in my diploma thesis and it got accepted. I could just continue and start my PhD without going through a very tough application process. Most of my peers in the lab, they actually had to apply, go through several rounds of interviews before they could come to the Max Planck Institute, because it's a very prestigious place. And I was so lucky that I could just sort of slide in there. And then when I had my PhD position, I could work with a very exciting group of people. And this group of people, first and foremost, my good friend Tegan, allowed me to do other stuff later on. If I wouldn't have gotten to know Tegan, I probably wouldn't have started my Plants and Pipettes blog then with her. And so again, this Plants and Pipettes thing was a major point in my CV when applying to jobs. So this probably would have had a big impact on my career. So yeah, it's important to acknowledge that sometimes there's luck involved. It's not just pure skill or making exactly the right decisions. And finally, I also want to talk about my privileges, because I'm a man, I'm native to the country that I work in, I speak both English and German, so these make a lot of the things much easier for me. So if you look at your own career and you can't get to certain places, it might just be that people with more privilege are having the advantage over you. It's not your skill, it's not something that you can actively do much about. I think it's also important to acknowledge that. And also that I, especially at the end of my PhD career, I was so lucky to be financially independent so that I could take my time and I didn't have to immediately take any job opportunity that came up and just jump on the first postdoc that would be offered to me so I could pay my rent and pay my bills. So I think it's important to acknowledge that, that it's not just my great decision making that got me where I am. So this is sort of the past. This is what I... my career, what I've been doing in the past, where I'm now. Now I want to talk a little bit about the skill of science communication and just a very, very brief overview over how to get into science communication, because maybe some of you are interested in that. Maybe you want to choose or do it similar to what I did, sort of move away from your main career, from an academic career, and just not do the science, talk about the science. So here are a couple of short points how I think is a good way to get into science communication. The first thing is you need to get your foot in the door, because it's not a traditional career. You can't just get a degree and then apply for entry level positions for science communication. Usually you have, the people who do this have a very diverse background. They come from all sorts of places. And so you sort of have to get your foot in the door. And the best thing to do that is to work with your local PR department, for example. They are often looking for people, for researchers that that can help them with programs, with projects that they do. So talk to your PR department. Maybe it's just standing at a table during the open doors and explain the research. Maybe it's something they need someone for social media, for an article. Maybe they need support in doing guided tours, all sorts of things. And just get in there and start working there. The other thing is to get online, use social media, Twitter, blogs, YouTube, podcasts, whatever you like to do, and tell people about your research. And in the process, you will get better at, first of all, explaining your research, but also at using these different techniques and different skills. Finally, the next part is getting smart. Learn from others, attend workshops, do classes. Actively seek out more knowledge. Just because you have a Twitter account might not mean that you fully understand how to use Twitter well, so maybe research that a little bit and get better at it. And finally, getting paid, because everything that I mentioned beforehand is often pro bono work, and so you need to make a living with a different career at the side. But if you actually want to make it your main career, look for part-time opportunities. I don't know if it's unfortunate, but there's a tendency, there's an overrepresentation of young women early in their career in ScienceCom offices. So there are often maternity leave positions that open. So people who go on maternity leave, and you can sort of get your first 6 months, 9 months, 10 months experience there, and then sort of build your career from that. This is how I got into my position. A colleague got, she was expecting a child, then left for maternity leave. They needed a replacement. I could jump in there and then work for 10 months there. And then we found a way to sort of extend that and turn her full-time position into two part-time positions. And both of us could continue to work there. is also internships and things like that. Part-time opportunities are sometimes not as attractive to other people, but maybe for you 50% is just the right amount to work. So find these sort of smaller entry positions where the competition is not as big, so you can get in there, build your CV, and then sort of grow and do more jobs. And talking about how to get into ScienceCom, there will be a workshop. I think with the current situation, we have to think about when we do this. We wanted to do this at the end of March, beginning of April, but I think we have to postpone this. So talk to Wiebke, she has all the information. I will run the workshop. We will cover the basics of science communication and also build your own format. So not only talk about the theoretical side of it, but also like how you personally could get into science communication. What would be the things that you care about? What is the right technique for you, the right format, the right medium? And what, how can you start your own ScienceCom project? Talk to Wiebke for that, and I hope we will find a way to do this this semester. It's all pretty unclear right now. Like it's a big it's a little bit blurry how we can proceed with that. So to finish, the takeaway message here is from that I want to give you sort of the things that I learned in my career is find what you love. In my case, it was communication. Find what you're an expert in. In my case, it was plant biology. Find the sort of hidden career that combines these two things, and always remember that no career is permanent. You are not set on a track. You don't have to like do two rounds of postdocs and then become a group leader. You can change your career at any given moment. And with that, thank you for your attention, for listening to me talk about my career. These are some links to my website, so you find my own personal website, joram.schwarzmann.de. That's also the thing behind the QR code on screen, which is in this format a little bit less useful. On plantsandpipettes.com, you find the blog that I run with Tegan. You can follow me on Twitter, which is @sciencejoram, and I'm happy to answer now any questions. Also in the future, you find ways to contact me through the links. So if in a week or a month or 6 months you think about science communication, always just shoot me a message. I'm very happy to help you. Thank you. And now I'm open for some questions, and I just have to look where I find these questions. So Stefan has a question. He asks, I have just started a Twitter account. Do you have any recommendations on how to use it as a beginner? So the first thing that I always recommend is start following people. This does two things. First of all, it fills your timeline, and you can sort of see what's called usually, like from back in the days from forums, it's called lurking. So you don't really post anything yet. You just sort of follow the conversation and see how people, I just see the server connection is down. I hope you can still hear me. If not, there is a backup recording that I'm doing that you can listen to later. Okay, so I'm still on the stream?
Yeah, for some it works.
Okay, so I'm still on the stream. I just, for now, I can't see your questions. I just hope maybe you can just give me the questions and then answer. So back to Twitter. So first thing you do is you lurk. You don't really post anything, you sort of see how other people are posting, because that gives you an idea of the type of language they use, the way they the way they're active, the way they interact with each other, which is very important, because you don't want to be sort of rude and just like step in there and with weird comments and replies that you think are valid, but actually in the context of sort of the Twitter sphere, it doesn't work. So lurk, observe, and learn. That's the first thing. But then when it actually comes to growing your audience, one of the best ways is to be very active in engaging with other accounts, not just posting your own ideas and not just posting links, but also to reply to other people, retweet with comments maybe, and contribute to the discussion. This then eventually helps you to grow your audience. Also, if you start following people, there's this trend that like a percentage of the people you follow will follow back. Some people abuse that and just follow thousands of accounts and then just by pure statistics get a couple hundred, maybe a thousand followers back. But this is not really, this is not sort of a nice way to build a following, because you're sort of spamming following. It also messes up your timeline to the point that you can't really use it anymore, because at one point you just start following random people that don't sort of that you actually don't care about. So, but following people and engaging with them and being active with them then often triggers that they follow you back. And in the end, it's just like making good content, providing interesting insights, interesting looks into, for example, if you tweet as a young researcher from the lab. If the things that you are tweeting about are interesting, people will share this stuff, and so with time we will grow. Just to give you a sort of estimate, for our Plants and Pipettes Twitter account, we started it somewhere in January, February 2019. By now we're about at about 2,000 followers. We post almost daily. We engage and interact, but I don't really do a lot of this following, just so people follow back. So just gives you an estimate of the time. Like, it takes a year of very active Twitter use with pushing a lot of content, because we push all of our things that we write for the blog on there. About a year to get to 2,000 people in my case. I know that other people who are much better at gaming sort of the algorithm, they have higher increases in followers, but I don't really see the point in doing Twitter to play with the algorithm. It's about engaging with other people. And so I'm more for like a slow but steady and honest growth. Yeah. So how well funded is science communication? And how well paid do you think you are compared to other people with similar education? Is the first question. Yes, the funding, it really depends. Right now, there is a trend to fund more science communication. The federal ministry actually put out a statement a couple of months ago about the importance of science communication. So it is expected that more and more grants will have an active science communication part in it, that you only get money for your research if you include science communication in your research grant. So funding is expected to increase. So far, we're still waiting to see the effects of these big statements, but I think I'm fairly positive about this in the future. The jobs that I worked at, I got a postdoc salary, which I find is a pretty good salary to get. It was like public money, so with all the public contracts, so the money was good there. Now, as if I'm doing some freelancing work, where it's a little bit harder, and freelance work is different. Also in terms of planning and responsibilities and so on, like a 9-to-5 job is pretty safe and calming, whereas freelancing, you have to get contracts and so on. But also there, I see that there is more and more demand for it, and I think you can make a decent living off it. And judging from my skill set, I spend a lot of time on my education. Other people have been working for 5 or 10 years already, and I'm just sort of still early career, because I just finished my PhD project stuff. But I got a postdoc salary out of it, and I think that's pretty standard for most people after their PhD ends. Yeah. The next question is, how competitive is it? Are there many people applying for each available position? That also depends. I think for the position that I initially applied for, this Plant 2030 job, there were about, I think, 3 good candidates that they selected between. I was actually second choice, but the first choice went elsewhere. So that's how I got lucky and got in there. So there was just like 3 people, and that's fairly low competition. I also apply now to a couple of other jobs, and there were definitely much more competition. You could just tell by the time it took for them to go through the applications and have several like interview rounds and so on. So it's definitely a competitive field, because I think many people either voluntarily or involuntarily have to drop out of the academic path. And anyone who's happy to communicate chooses then science communication. It's a very like easy first choice to make. So there's definitely some competition, but at the same time, I feel that in the field of new media, social media and digital communication tools and so on, there aren't actually that many people who are really good at it. So if you build their skill set now, you have a pretty important skill set that many people are looking for and not many people can provide. So I think if you go that direction, you can sort of find a niche that you are very good in and where you have a unique point and less competition. So how do you think the long-term job perspectives are in science communication? You mentioned that there are not that many job positions. Yes, for long-term jobs, I mean, I've been doing this now for 1.5 years in a job, then I did my paternity leave and now I'm starting again. I think it is, especially in the beginning of your career, very similar to this short-term postdoc contract thing, where you have a project, it runs for a couple, usually, hopefully more than a couple of months. It runs for like a year or two, and then you have to find another follow-up job. I know that my old boss, he's been doing it for 5 or 6 years, and he's still doing it sort of on the same funding. He has to find different funding from time to time, but the main core of his job stayed the same. And I think he managed to make a sort of permanent career out of this. He funded now, started his own company for science communication now. And I think there is not an end in sight, so it's something that can go on. From my experience, it's these shorter contracts. Although there are many job positions offered now that are sort of 2 years with an option for long-term extension. Because right now, for example, there is a joint cooperation from the Humboldt University, Freie University, Technical University, and Charité that's just starting right now, and they're hiring, and they're hiring people long-term. So you can, with a little bit of luck, you can find a place where you can stay much longer than you can stay in your average postdoc lab. The next question is, was it beneficial to get your PhD instead of switching earlier? Yeah, that's a very good question. Thank you for asking that, because I wonder that very often, especially during the very hard times of my PhD. And looking back, there were really tough times, definitely challenging times. And I wondered in hindsight now, should I have quit back then? Should I have, instead of like putting up with all of the bad stuff that was thrown at me, should I have just said like, screw this, I'm out. And I don't know, to be honest. I think, if I'm honest, the skills that I'm using now in my work, I acquired my scientific skills by like year two of my PhD. And after that, I just get better at it. But I could read papers by year two. I could make scientific presentations, could critically think about projects and so on. But main thing for me was the connections I made during my PhD time. But it was also like after year two that I realized really academia is not something for me. So year three, and I got an extension for another half a year, so that I did 3.5 years in total. So the last year and a half of my PhD project, I sort of knew that I have to set the foundation for other stuff. So I got close with some people. I use the time, like I knew that I don't want to put 150% of my time into my research. Instead, I put like 90% of my time into my research, and then the 10% and whatever I had in my free time, I could use for a different career. So I don't really have a good answer whether or not I would recommend finishing your PhD for that. I'm right now, I almost finished writing my thesis. It's just in the last rounds of revision right now before I can actually submit it. But I don't expect that it will change my prospects at jobs if I have a doctor title in front of my name, because I think for the things that I'm doing, at least my skills are not affected by this, and I apply usually with the projects that I have been working on and the skills that I had in these projects, and I don't apply with just my formal education and my my doctorate title and so on. But that being said, all my colleagues at Esplan 2030 Jobs, all of them had a PhD. So maybe I'm just lucky again that I can convince people that I'm good at what I'm doing without actually having the doctor title. Do you have any more questions? Yeah, you can send questions to Wiebke. You can send them in by email. I have like two very nice people helping me to get your questions to me. And
right now.
Yeah.
No, I have another question.
Yeah.
Question: are you communicating only science from your old field, or also other fields? And how difficult is it to actually communicate something which you're not familiar with?
Ah, yeah, that's also a good point. So I hope you could hear that. So do I just communicate my own research or like my own expertise field, which is plant biology, or do I also do other stuff? And how hard is it to talk about other things? And in the past, professionally, I've been very close to the plant field, but I have to be honest, like my PhD project was protein biochemistry. And I learned a lot about mass spectrometry these sort of things, data analysis and growing tobacco and Arabidopsis. I have no idea about moss biology or transcriptomics and these things. And still, especially at Plants and Pipettes, I'm talking about all of these things because if you have a basic understanding for how science works, you can very quickly understand it also from less related fields to what you actually worked in. It can be sometimes challenging, but if you choose a communication career, I think one of the qualities that you should have is sort of think quick and identify the things that matter to the story. So you want to tell somebody about your research paper or about a research paper, and you want to get just 2-3 points across. You don't want to go into the details of, let's say if it would be a physics paper where they test material properties, I don't have to explain them how an atomic grid works with different atoms in there, which elements are used in there. I want to tell them about the properties of the material and how the new property that they studied, how that affects maybe future technologies. And identifying these things, these key elements in any research story is something that I think you are able to do at a certain point when you read a lot of research papers from your field and from closely related fields, you very quickly can go to different parts. I mean, I have to be honest, if I would have to present a complete like a theoretical math paper, I would struggle because they have a completely different way of making their argument, making their case. They don't do experiments. But I think for anything that's experimental or technical, I have a very good understanding of how to find the interesting points in it. So you don't have to be locked into your topic. I mean, I really like plants, so I have the most fun talking about plants. But actually, in the future, I'm looking forward to doing work with in other contexts where it's not plants. Because yeah, I talked a lot about plants. I'm really happy to talk about other things. So the next question is, would the strategy to get into political counseling lobbying be similar to what you described, since you mentioned the BMBF and since both paths heavily depend on communication? I think in policy counseling and so on, it's a little bit more formal. The science communicators are a little bit more easygoing because it's a little bit, especially with like social media and this stuff, it's a little bit more loose. And with political counseling, I think from the people that I worked with that were sort of leaning in that direction, they need a little bit more like solid expertise, and it's something that's a little bit harder to do in your own time. I think if you work sort of voluntarily in an NGO, you can get some of that experience. So I think getting this firsthand experience in your own time is still a valid point to get into this. But your building your skill set is, I think, much harder, because in science communication, I can just set up a blog and I can go like a Twitter account and Instagram and all of these things, and we can start filling them with content and getting better at this. I think it's much harder to do this when you have to do, or when you want to do policy counseling. So I think there you would have to rely much more on traditional ways of getting in there, which means maybe getting an additional degree in political sciences or doing internships with politicians and these sort of jobs, which are often not very well paid, or you have to pay on top of that, which makes it often very hard to do after a scientific career. And I think that's as far as my knowledge goes into that field. So I hope that helps a little bit. Okay. Yeah. So if there are no more. I think we can wait a few more minutes for if there's other questions. If there are no more questions, you can always shoot me an email. It's just joram@schwarzmann.de. So my first name, joram, at Schwarzmann, which is schwarzmann.de. You could also find it on the on my last slide, on my website, and so on. Just message me there if you have further questions, and then I'm very happy to get back to you in an email. Yeah, I'm just hearing in my director is telling me that there is a message incoming. Is there going to be a recording? Yes. There's an audio recording of me speaking that will be provided to you after we're done here.
There are lots of things and thumbs
up. Yeah, I'm happy if I could help you. And again, if you are now interested in science communication, prepare yourself mentally for a workshop announcement that will soon come if we figure out how we can do this with the current virus situation, where we will dive much deeper into the skills of science communication. And what I want to do there is much more than just social media and blogging. It's about finding the right method that you want to use. So do you want to do it in person? Do you want to create events? Do you want to do tours, work with journalists, and so on? So a lot of things that are not just digital media, but also we'll dive deeper into how to be active on Twitter, Instagram, how to start a YouTube account if you are interested in doing video stuff. I just briefly talked about video stuff during my work at Plan 2030, but maybe you want to be a science YouTuber. We will talk about this, and then we will together find the right method and format and storyline for you, and I'll give you some tools how to do this either in the workshop or later when you want to actually start a science communication project. So look out for that. We're in the process of getting that finalized. With that, I think we're done.
Yeah, thank you all for joining us, and thank you, Joram, for being here today. And we will send out the audio file, whatever. We will do this, and take care, all of you, and talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.